defeating the radical left, the Marxists, the anarchists, the agitators, the looters, and people who in many instances have absolutely no clue what they are doing.
Recording?
Yeah, oh yeah, it's recording.
All right.
Yeah.
Because we haven't been doing this every week.
No, we got to get back on that.
Bi-weekly. We're coming out as bi.
Coming out as bi-weekly. No, we're going to get back on the weekly thing.
Yeah,
we got to get back on that. I'm being lazy. You two were actually busy. I am being lazy. I feel like I've earned some laziness and I'm enjoying my unemployment.
Hey, you're living your best life.
Oh my God, so much baseball. It's just my unemployment coinciding with the baseball season starting is just the greatest gift of all time. I have been rotting on my couch watching, I'm not even kidding you, on like a weekend where there's a lot of baseball, I'm watching 10 to 12 hours of baseball in a day.
Who's without your favorite team?
The Blue Jays. But they piss me off.
Favorite player?
On the current team?
Sure.
Kevin Gausman. Of all time, Roy Halladay or Carlos Delgado?
You we look at us going. As if we know.
You're just blank, staring back.
I'm also like a slight Pittsburgh Pirates fan, and I don't root against the Tigers, unless they're in direct competition with the Blue Jays.
You're wearing a Detroit Tigers hat right now.
True. Currently, I am. I have a lot of hats. I usually wear my Chicago White Sox hat.
I feel like you're taking a chauvinist position by putting the Blue Jays above the Tigers because.
Is that a chauvinist position? Explain.
Well, yeah, because they're Canadian. Even though they're farther away, they're less your team in terms of proximity and in terms of culture. But because of the border here,
no, you're absolutely
you're caving
correct
to that.
You're absolutely correct.
A real internationalist would be a Detroit
yes.
Tigers fan.
If you were born and raised in Windsor and you're not a Tigers fan, I'm sus. I was born on the other side of Toronto. I grew up a Blue Jays fan.
That's fair.
Oh, that's facts.
Yeah, I was 8 years old when they won the World Series for the first time, so I was locked in. That's just how it is. I don't think either of you were born when they won that. Well, you. Mm-hmm. How old are you? 32?
Mm-hmm.
So you were born right around that time.
I'm 91.
Okay, so you're alive. You weren't making memories, but you were alive.
What year was this?
92 and 93. They won the World Series.
Yeah. Okay.
So I was
I
at
have
the prime
fond
age.
Memories of my younger years, so but yeah. I don't remember this.
Yeah,
I wouldn't
remember
baseball.
Being an infant watching Joe Carter hit
I
a home run.
It was,
yeah. Anyway, we can make this a baseball podcast if
no.
you'd like.
No, thank you.
I have no problem doing that.
It's a hard no for me.
You don't want to preview the 2024 season? Who's winning the World Series?
I feel like it would just be you talking and us being like,
I am kind of amused by asking you questions like who's going to win the World Series in 2024 and having you answer
the Penguins?
Yes, the Penguins, correct. What about you? Who's winning the...
I ain't going to go with that too because I...
Also the Penguins?
Also yes. The Penguins.
Yeah. Is that a real team?
A hockey team is going to win the Baseball World Series. That's great. I love it.
It's a hockey team?
Yes.
The Pittsburgh? Is it a Pittsburgh?
Penguins,
is it really?
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
They're going to win.
That was a
the
guess.
Pirates are the baseball team.
The Pirates.
The Pirates.
Pittsburgh Ooh. Pirates?
Yes.
Come on.
They're the best. Well, they're black and gold. They got a great uniform thing going on.
I need to look at this.
They have the most beautiful ballpark in the world. PNC Park in Pittsburgh is fucking insane.
So are you just into it for the uniforms and
not
the setting? Or
yeah,
like,
what are you in it?
Literally,
why do you watch this?
You're just like, yeah, their uniforms are so
really,
cute.
I do really like the uniforms, you guys. I get really into uniform aesthetics. That is true. We don't, okay. We just had a great interview and we were talking about baseball. Mm-hmm. So if you're listening to this, I don't know what order we're going to put this in yet. I feel like we should put this first.
Yeah.
So welcome back to the River and the Land. Travis Laver, Bilal Rafiq, Cameron Francis. We just finished our interview with Dr. Ricardo Tranjan. I'm going to continue calling him Dr. Ricardo Tranjan because he doesn't like it.
For the respect, yeah.
Yeah, he gets the respect whether he wants it or not.
Exactly.
But the author of The Tenet Class, someone we've been talking about since the inception of this podcast. So you have to listen to us talk for a little bit. And if you don't want to, just fast forward to like the half hour mark and listen to Ricardo because it was great. I'm invigorated by that interview.
Yeah, it was really, really good.
It was really good. If you haven't read The Tenet Class yet, it's a quick read. You can get it in lots of different places. BTLbooks.com is a publisher. You can find it in local bookstores and libraries. And failing that, you can just email Ricardo, which we talk about in the segment. So yeah, that was great.
It was fantastic. Well, it's just cool because I feel like he's someone who really has had an impact on this podcast.
Oh, yeah.
More than anyone, except for maybe like Karl Marx. I don't know.
He's up there, yeah.
But yeah, like we've referenced this guy's work so many times. We love this book. We're always talking about it. And just like living the way we do and doing what we do for work and stuff, especially, like, this is a really key, like, framework that I think we're always applying, so it's cool to be able to like dive into it a little bit more with him.
As someone who's spent their entire adult life renting, this book validated a lot of my feelings. Mm-hmm. I think that's a big part of this, is that I think as renters and as working class people, we're gaslit constantly mm-hmm. into blaming ourselves for everything that goes wrong in our lives. And like the fact that I have paid, I don't even want to calculate the number. I could calculate the amount of money that I have paid to landlords, but it's enough for me to buy a fucking house. Mm-hmm. No question.
Like outright.
Yeah. So like the fact that that has been taken from me mm-hmm. as a member of the tenant class, the working class, you know, this book just does a really good job of validating that experience. Like, you're not crazy. This is fucked up.
Yeah.
And here's how it's fucked up. Here are the hard numbers. Here's all the myths that you're told that don't seem right.
Yeah.
Here's all the history of organizing, and here's how you can make it better, mm-hmm. which is a sort mm-hmm. of classic manifesto. And I love reading manifestos. So,
exactly. Yeah. I mean, like, I hate academics, to be honest. Yeah. Like, someone like this is not a book that we were supposed to like. Coming from like someone who's part of like a policy think tank with a PhD and all these things, but like even in the interview he's like, I should not, like, I'm speaking against the job I have. Yeah. It's not people in policy think tanks that should be making these decisions, and the solution is never going to come from like the political intelligentsia or anyone in a position of power. Mm-hmm. It's going to come from social movements, and I, as an expert on this, advocate for the tenants themselves. Ye proletarians rise up and take over.
He's the kind of academic that, he's the kind of person that you like, you hope academics can be, because there's space for them to do it, but oftentimes there's so many external pressures to conform to that sort of academic lifestyle. And yeah, you know, the world's pretty fucked up, but maybe if we try to change it from within, like that kind of attitude, which is mm-hmm. what, you know, one of the things that ruined my PhD experience was that I had a bunch of academics in my ear telling me to write a policy document. And I didn't want to write a fucking policy mm-hmm. document. I wanted to write a manifesto or something right. along those lines, right? That was more politically radical. And it can be really, really tough to carve out a space in academia to do that. And so the fact that Ricardo's done that is really cool. Mm.
Do you feel like you were pressured into not? Like what did that pressure look like? Without
very
like
soft
names or whatever?
Yeah, I can't name names because I might go back and finish it at some point. But not with those people, however. It's like soft stuff. So like I would submit a draft of a chapter, or I would just go in for a conversation about here's what I'm thinking about for writing this chapter or writing this part. And I would get pushback. Well, you know, who's your audience? Who's your audience for this dissertation? I'm like, well, partly it's the people who I studied. I want them to read it. I want them to understand it. And also I want other working class people to read it and understand something about poverty, you know, and something about inequality and homelessness and all these different ways that people have to survive. And what I got was, well, that's not your audience. It shouldn't be that. Your audience should be other academics, and it should be policymakers.
So your audience for a book about poverty and those in poverty should be people who are not in poverty.
Yes.
And it should not be understandable to the people who experience that.
So I got told by one of my advisors pretty early on in the process, she would always say, you're a good writer. You're a really good writer. And, you know, I took that as a compliment. Mm-hmm. But I found out in academic circles, that's not a compliment. That is you're a good writer, that means you're a bad academic. Which she did actually tell me later. She's like, I suspect you're a bad academic because you're such a good writer.
I don't get that. Why is that a thing?
Because, like, if you write stuff that's understandable by normal people, i.e. being a good writer, you're probably not using enough jargon, bullshit. You know, your audience isn't the correct audience. Mm-hmm. And it's this sort of sneaky way of being like, your writing's too accessible. You need to bring it up a level. And it's like, well, I can bring it up. I have the ability to do that, but I'm not writing for that. And I don't have any interest in writing for that. But anyway,
that's interesting.
I don't want to make this a whole thing about me, but it was a lot of like subtle stuff, or I'd submit a draft and it would be like, well, this is fine, but like, how are you supposed to hand this to a city councilor and have them do anything about it? And it's like, well, I didn't fucking write it for the city councilors. Like, if you notice, I'm pretty critical of them. Yeah. Actually,
I feel like that translates a lot to like even just how he wrote this book about like for tenants. And it's not for academics. It's not for, you know, the private ownership class or the landlord class. It's for people like me and people that rent, and you and Bilal, and like, just, I don't know. It's great that like he speaks to us and he's giving us like this framework of like how to understand this. And I agree with you. It does feel very validating.
Yeah.
I think there's so much discourse and it drives me insane seeing non-stop like just discourse about just everything framed towards, you know, the landlords and developers and like people that are not the tenants and people that are not people that pay rent to a landlord. We are totally ignored in the discourse all the time, and it's never about us. We're never included in the conversation, and I love this book because it is validating. It feels very gaslighting to be someone who is a renter who perhaps has I have a slum landlord for the last 3 years been treated like shit by my landlord and been bullied by them. And it's like, this book has helped empower me. It's the only thing that's I've ever read that's like speaking to me.
Yeah.
That kind of just acknowledges like the feeling of just recognizing the exploitation that I'm feeling as a renter.
Yeah.
It's so infuriating to feel this just being exploited, and just you feel it, but no one's validating this and no one caters to the conversation. Like all the politicians locally are always focused on developers and everyone but us. And we are a huge portion, especially downtown.
Yeah.
Huge portion of the population are renters. It's a third, right?
That's why the class analysis is so important. Like you cannot have a serious conversation about housing within that framework, or just the idea that you could hand a book like this to a politician, or you could hand your dissertation in progress to a politician, because that would miss the point that the politicians are actually often the beneficiaries of the system being the way it is, or at the very least they are tied and in bed with the people who do directly benefit from this. So without that class analysis, you miss the solution entirely, because it's not that everyone needs to come together and we need to put our best minds to it and come up with these like technical policy changes. We need to look at it as two antagonistic forces, one of which is exploiting the other and benefiting from the immiseration of the other. Yeah. And anything that doesn't start from that point of view misses the point. Going through it from a policy point of view misses the point, because it's ultimately about this larger group of people who's being exploited taking power for themselves, because the people who are exploiting them, why the fuck would they give them power? They're benefiting immensely from their immiseration. Yeah. It's like anything like that. Like it's anyway.
Yeah. And I mean, my dissertation was about panhandling as a specific mode of survival, right? Within all of this. And like the idea that I would spend years reading, like arguably I didn't read the stuff. I did read the stuff that they wanted me to read in my program, but I also read a lot of other shit because I recognized there were gaps in what I was being told to read. So I read a lot of extra Marx, and I read a lot of Luxembourg and Engels, and I read a lot of stuff that like just wasn't, you know, it wasn't the Foucault, Lacan, postmodern sort of shit that I was being made to read, which not all of it's bad. I'm not saying that it is. Like, some of it actually very insightful and very great, but you know, and then I go out on the street for a year with folks. I embed myself with them I wouldn't say in a very real way, because I still was going home at night, but you know, I was out there every single day for 7 days a week for a year, you know, sitting with them, going to their houses, you know, like, or going to their apartments, going, you know, hanging out with them, that I would then turn around and write a document for a liberal bourgeois audience out of that. I mean, maybe a liberal bourgeois person can read what, you know, Ricardo's writing or what I was trying to write, but they're probably not going to get the message that they should fix it through policy. You know, like, at least that wouldn't be, like, again, not my target audience. And it was really hard in an academic circle to get people to give a shit about any other target audience except for other academics and other people in the ruling class. Mm-hmm. So when you see an academic doing it, and they do exist because there is a space for it, if you work with the right people and the right institutions, you can carve out a spot for it. It's one of the few places you can do that. Mm-hmm. It's an achievement. I want to tell a story if I can. So I went home a couple weeks ago. And when I do, I hang out with some folks there, one of which is one of my best friends in the world, someone I've known since grade 10. And, you know, he's a great dude, but he's a lawyer, pretty successful one at this point. And so he's got a lot of friends, people around who are a part of that class. Mm. And so when I go there, my broke ass goes and hangs out with them. It's like, it can be a little bit, not with him, but with some of, and not even some of the other people. Again, if you're listening, I love a lot of those people, but there's some people sometimes who say some things and do some things, and it's just very uncomfortable being this like working class person amongst this sort of professional middle class group. Mm. You know, they have very different problems, very different conversation topics than I typically have with the people I associate with here. And I just find it almost fascinating. I feel like I'm at a zoo sometimes. I'm like, oh, this is...
What kind of things are they talking about?
Oh, like, I don't know, mortgage rates and investments and like shit. I'm just like, wow, you guys have like a whole different lexicon of things you're talking about. Yeah. Like, wow. So yeah, your investment property is not doing as well as you wanted to. That's got to be a shame. Wow. Like, yeah, I my toilet doesn't sit properly on the floor. My landlord won't fix it. It's weird. But anyway, so we're having this conversation, and in my hometown, it's Cobourg, Ontario. It's east of Toronto. It's a little town. It's about half the size of Chatham for people around here for reference. It's a small town, but it's in sort of GTA adjacent. So there's lots of, you know, stuff around. But anyway, there's a burgeoning homelessness problem there, because what we're seeing is that homelessness used to be something that only really happened, even as recently as the 80s and 90s, only really happened in big cities, mm-hmm. like Toronto, Vancouver, Montreal. That's where you would see homelessness. Mm-hmm. If you saw it elsewhere, it was minimal, it was out of sight. And then what we've seen in the last 20 years is that sort of filtering down to smaller cities like Windsor, mm-hmm. like Kitchener-Waterloo, places like that. Now we're seeing it filter down to small towns. And like most small towns in Southern Ontario have some sort of homeless encampment, including Cobourg. And it has become this big issue in Cobourg because they've never dealt with this shit before. It's the talk of town. Everybody needs to talk about homelessness. There's a couple of like groups that try to sort of address the issue, some more radical, some more liberal. And the conversation at this table I was at turned to how they hated the homeless now. They used to be sympathetic, but now they fucking hate them. They can't fucking stand this shit anymore. And you know what? These people are just bad people. And like, they, you know, I don't care what happens to them. Fuck them. I don't care what happens to them. They're assholes and they don't deserve anything. If they don't want to go to a shelter and they don't want to live in a tent, then fuck them. We do everything we can to try to get them into a place where they're safe and they don't want to be there. So fuck them. Let them be on the street. Let's get rid of them. Like, I don't know how to say this in any other way, so I'm just going to say it. Fascist ass language, talking about a group of people who are living in tents, not people with fucking power.
It's crazy when people have a disdain for people that right. are down bad like that. Like, I just don't understand anything besides having empathy for these folks. It's right. so strange to me that people have, but I understand that, like, I don't know. I think about this a lot because I hear it a lot here too, where people have this disdain for the homeless. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because it reminds them, it's scary. That's a scary reality to see someone in. And I think it scares people. Mm-hmm. Maybe if they make all the right decisions, they'll never be homeless. So the people that are homeless must have made bad decisions. It's that just world hypothesis of just believing that, you know, if you're a good person, if you make the right decisions, you'll be protected from being homeless, when it's not, it's a system problem. Yeah.
And really, it's generational wealth. Do you have it?
Yeah.
That's what protects you from homelessness, right? Do you have, even just not even generational wealth, but just, do you have a support network that has money? You know?
I honestly hate the conversation around this most of the time, where it's like, they like, empathy is conditional on whether it was a tragedy where you're homeless or whether you made bad decisions. And I'm like, I'm sure many people did make bad decisions.
Yeah.
Ultimately,
we all do.
When we, no matter what happened, like,
systemic stuff and individual choice are not, it's not two, it's two sides of the same coin. You are more likely to make certain decisions depending on your starting point, basically, and the conditions you live in. But say someone had it made, you know, and they just fucked it up. I don't really care. You know, my like, empathy shouldn't be conditional on, like, on things like that. I don't know if this is coming across the right way, but I just mean, like, I think we should look at it not from a point of view of, like, oh, they did this and they ended up here. We should just look at it from a point of view of, like, there are people in this situation now. There are people who are unhoused now. There are people on the streets experience addiction now. We don't need to backtrack and be like, oh, how did they get here? What choices did they make where they ended up here? Are they a bad person? Do they have mental health shit? The starting point and the end point should really be like, there are people now in this position. How do we reduce this as a society and get people not in conditions where they're more likely to die?
Yeah. And I find it ironic because a lot of the discourse ends up being about drug use, right? And these people are openly using drugs in public. They're behaving, they get high, and then they're behaving in the way that we don't necessarily understand or want. And the irony that we're all sitting in a fucking bar getting fucking plastered, like literally all of us getting very drunk and having this conversation is we can just afford the wine. That's the only fucking difference between us and them, right? And like, and I just, I don't know, like this person, that this specific person I'm thinking of, you know, they're a liberal and they sort of, I think anyway, brand themselves as a liberal and think of themselves as a progressive leaning liberal even. And I think this is one of those things where it's liberalism's mask that just comes off, right? Where it's like, it's Phil Oakes who wrote the song Love Me, I'm a Liberal. Before he would perform it, he would say this line where he said, you know, liberals a peculiar beast, 10 degrees to the left of center when things are good and 10 degrees to the right of center when it affects them personally. And that's like literally what I was seeing in action. Is this is a person who I've heard say some almost communist, if not fully communist shit when it doesn't affect them. Right? But like as soon as it's an inconvenience to them, or they have to see it, or they have to deal with it.
How does it affect them? Or do they just see it?
I don't know. I don't actually know. I don't know how the homeless encampment affects this person. I don't suspect it does very much, but I don't know. I don't want
to
speak for them.
Do you have to be a good person to deserve housing? Well, that's the thing. If that's the litmus test, then like all these assholes should be on the street too then.
Yeah, and I just like and I pose the question, I'm like, well, you know, people behave that way in homeless encampments in Windsor too, and everywhere else I've ever been to see a Peterborough, and everywhere else I've ever been to see a homeless encampment, they you know, behavior's not always behaving in ways that liberal polite society would like. Does that mean that homeless people just across the board are fucking terrible people? And the answer was yes. And I was like, wait, I think you just lost your liberal card, but maybe you didn't. Maybe you actually fit in perfectly. I don't know.
That is liberalism, though.
Yeah. And it was kind of echoed around the table. Like, yeah, you know, these homeless people are really a fucking problem. They're the problem?
Wow.
Yet you don't look at the landlords who have fucking bought every little piece of land in this fucking town and have used it to profit? You don't look at them as the problem, but the guy in the tent who's on meth and having a hard fucking day is your problem?
Yeah.
Yeah, look
up. What are you doing? Anyway, I know we talk about this shit a lot, but it was just like,
it's never their problem. Look up.
Yeah.
Like, you gotta look up.
Yeah. Don't look at the person down who, like, you know, has mud on their pants because that's where they had to sleep last night. They're probably not your problem.
No.
They don't have any fucking power.
Honestly.
Over your life or anybody else's.
And if you don't like seeing it, advocate for these people to get housing.
Yeah. And not that's shelters.
Not
fucking even tiny homes, although I will say at least that's some sort of, like, safe locking door, even if it's insufficient. The idea that, like, well, we have shelters. What's their fucking problem? Shelters have rules that are often very difficult for people with addictions and who've been living hard to follow. They are often abusive, horrible places where your shit gets stolen and you get the shit kicked out of you. And there's always drama on the street, right? That's a thing that is, you can't get away from it if you're in a shelter. It's just there, you know? And you know, talking to people as I have who've been living rough, they don't fucking want to go to shelters. They will go when it's cold and that's about it. Otherwise, they stay the fuck out of them. They don't want to be around it.
It's crazy because without shelter, you're likely going to die. And we make it illegal for people to build any sort of makeshift shelter. Like the police
will come and tear it down.
Exactly. And it's like, so basically it's, you know, if it, I don't know. It's just like they make it so that like it's so difficult to survive in a circumstance of you being homeless. It's literally not to say it's a death sentence, but like it is very scary. Like, I don't know.
I have residual secondary trauma from talking to people for a year about it. And like how, and like whenever my financial reality comes into question, which it often does because I'm poor, I have a fucking meltdown in a way that nothing else in the world can make me have a meltdown, in the way that the potential of maybe kind of sort of being homeless does. Because I have seen it. And I know the stories of the people who've ended up in those situations. I know how they got there. And I'm telling you, those stories aren't different from yours and mine. They're not. Right? It's very easy to fall into it. I've talked to people about how they didn't even realize that they were homeless until they were already homeless. Like, oh, fuck, I guess I'm homeless now. Because it's just, it can happen in such a way that's like, oh, I got this friend's couch to stay on, or I can stay at this place for a little bit. I'm not homeless. I'm just struggling.
If you're couch surfing, you're homeless.
Yeah. And then
you're living in your car, you're homeless.
Yeah.
You're
and without your eventually, own home. Like, eventually, you'll lose those things because you can't just couch surf for the rest of your life. Like, people get, you know, you wear out your welcome with even the best of people. And you end up on the fucking street. And like, the trauma of that experience, I know I've said it before on this podcast, I can't emphasize enough how there might not be another thing in our contemporary society besides active war that is more traumatizing to the human mind than not having a locking door and shelter. It is, what it does to the human psyche is very similar to what happens in war, actually. And there's been studies about that, about what it does to your brain chemistry. And so to have people turn around and say, well, fuck those people, they're bad people, or they just don't want to live in a shelter or whatever. Like, give your fucking head a shake. Like, I don't know.
It lacks empathy.
What do they think?
Yeah. Psychopath.
Yeah.
Well, so, I would also just say, like, what do these people think that the existing services for homeless people are? Like, yeah. You go to shelter half the time, you're just like a mat on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
if it's a bed, it's probably got bed bugs.
Yeah,
it's a fucking horrible place. It's a horrible
place
to be.
You have a huge risk of confrontation with other people because there's always a lot of drama. You have, and obviously, people living rough and emotions are high. You have huge risk of theft. There's tons of drug use a lot of the time. Maybe you're in recovery and you're trying to do whatever, you know, like being on a program for recovery and homeless, you know, not really the most ideal situation or most conducive to like recovery, you know.
Yeah.
It's just crazy. Like this idea that like, oh, we spoil them, we give them enough, they're fine, it's their choice because they're not going to the mission. It's like, what do you think these places are? They're all underfunded.
Yeah. and even in a place like Coburg, where I suspect, I haven't been to the shelter in Coburg. I keep meaning to go and I don't go, but I suspect that it's like probably a little bit more well-funded than, say, the Mission, just because it is a small town full of very wealthy people. But I don't know. Maybe it's not. Maybe it's exactly the same kind of shit. I don't know. But either way, it's not ideal. And if you have people that are willing to live in tents in the cold in Canada before they go to a shelter, my question would not be to the people living in the tents. My question would be, what are the conditions in the shelter that are making people not want to go there?
Mm-hmm.
And trust me, there are answers to those questions. If you ask the people who have the option of going to those places, if you actually engage with them and talk to them, they will tell you why they don't go there.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty openly, anybody who wants to listen.
If you're a rich asshole who hates people that are down bad, that are living in poverty, that are panhandling or living in a tent or homeless, like, fuck you for being such a shitty fucking person.
And I don't, and again, if you're listening, we're not talking about you because I know you well enough to know that I think you were upset that
this
night.
This is a thing.
But like, it's a thing.
This is a mentality that we see in our politicians.
Mm-hmm.
Their disdain for the homeless and people that are in poverty, how they want to hide them from view because they want to make downtown palatable to rich people. Everything is centered around, how do we make rich folks comfortable? How do we get them to spend money? How do we hide the homeless?
Or just the middle class, even. Just anybody with consumer income that can, like, buy stuff.
It is the... I hear it all the time. And, like, we live downtown. Every day in and day out, I see homeless people. They're in my backyard. They're out in the front of my building. Like, I see them all the time, and I think about them all the time because I see them, and it's like I'm not even living on the street, and I'm traumatized by just seeing them.
Seeing the way they have to live,
and
yeah.
I think when you see them, it could cause one of two things in a person. Either you want to help them, and you want to help, like, advocate for things that they need, or you're an asshole, and you go, I don't want to look at that.
Or what's their fucking problem? They're causing my day to be worse, which it's never been clear to me how. I mean, like, yes, okay. In areas where there's a lot of extreme poverty, higher theft rates, break-in rates, these sorts of things that can be inconvenient, annoying. And I've lived in these fucking neighborhoods my whole adult life, and I've had shit stolen from me. I've had my shit broken into, my car broken into, my bike stolen. Yeah, it fucking sucks, and I get really mad about it.
In this exact apartment.
Yeah.
But advocate for a society where that doesn't have to be the case.
Right, I don't blame the people doing it, because they probably would be doing something else if there was a fucking option for them. Yeah,
exactly. Right? Exactly.
So, like, when my bike gets stolen, I don't get mad at the person who stole it. I get mad at my fucking landlord for not fixing the goddamn fucking door that goes into the bike room, and I get mad at the politicians who make it so that people have to steal bikes to fucking eat.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's who I get mad at. You know?
Yep.
Exactly. Anyway.
Point the finger in the right direction. It's the, like, and I think Ricardo Tranjan, to bring it back to the book, like, he does a great job being like, it's not just a housing crisis where you can't point the finger. It's so, you can point the finger to these things, and I think that's why the politicians don't want you to see the poverty, because then they don't want you they don't want you to point the finger at them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because ultimately, if you pull that thread, why are these people here?
Mm-hmm.
What's going on? Why do we live in Canada, one of the 8 richest countries in the entire fucking world?
For who?
Right. like why do we have an abundance of wealth in this country? Again, the 8th richest country in the world. We are insanely wealthy in this country. Why do we have people who can't afford to eat and live in a fucking heated place with a locking door? And you start pulling on that thread, mm-hmm. and you start getting to the answer, and you're right. Those people in power are going to be fucking like, well, fuck, don't look at us. But most people just don't. Well, I'm not that person, so they're just annoying me, and fuck them, you know? And we have to change that mentality. Like, I really do. Like, I think working class people need to, like, you are in solidarity with these folks. You are more like them than you are like these other people. And it's easy to fall into that. Like, the amount of times that I've almost been homeless, you know, and if it weren't for a few safety nets and a little bit of privilege that I've got, I would be homeless. Absolutely. Yeah. There's no way I'd be able to live the life I did and be homeless. Like, I got saved on multiple occasions from it. So, like, am I an asshole? Because, like, if I had ended up in that spot, I'd probably be doing meth and fucking behaving like a shithead too.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that even everybody who's on the street does that, because that's not true either, right? Like Bilal said last time, like, the sweetness and the kindness of people who are in the worst situations will always move me.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But there are people who behave badly. And everyone, when you're having a shitty day and you take it out on your partner, you know, or something like that, imagine that times a million.
Yeah.
Well, it's people have a baseline mentally of where they're at, and they have a threshold. And when you're in conditions that push you really close to that threshold, or are more likely to put you beyond that threshold, then you're going to be more triggered, and you're going to be more susceptible to, like, lashing out and having certain behavior. And unfortunately, because you don't have a space, you don't have any privacy, even to go to the bathroom. You're doing that publicly. We are at our worst publicly, whereas house people could be at our worst privately.
Yeah.
And we probably all do things that are far worse than homeless people do. It's just, we do that around our spouses and our kids and our friends and family.
Yeah. I mean, like, when I was a younger man and got frustrated at a situation, I punched a fridge and broke my hand. You know? there was another time I lost a scholarship that was literally keeping me alive, and I went to fix a clock in my living room and it wouldn't fucking fix, and I tossed it out the window. Right? Yeah. But I did that in the confines of my own home by myself. And I'm not saying it's good behavior. I'm just saying that, you know, if I was on the street, I mean, first of all, losing a scholarship would be the least of my problems, but yeah, I mean, we're all prone to, like, meltdowns, right? Yeah. Especially working class people who struggle.
Are you more or less deserving of a shelter?
No, we can go drink. We can go to Fog and get wasted, and that's our escape. you know, but for folks in the street, they can't fucking do that. Yeah. So they got to do other shit.
Stop judging people who have no privacy to like that need. Like I have a meltdown every day practically. And true. Like if I didn't have the privacy of my house, like I would be, people would be pointing at me being like, that bitch is crazy. Because yeah. I am. And also, I do talk to myself sometimes out loud in public. And I'm like, it is a thing. I talk to myself out loud in my home constantly.
Oh, yeah. In my home, I do constantly.
Yeah.
It's like a running conversation.
Yeah. A full-on conversation.
Absolutely. Anyway, like, I feel like we're in rant. I'm definitely in rant mode now.
It's good to ramp up.
But I think we're good. For time, yeah, so probably. we can get to the interview with Dr. Ricardo Tranjan, author of The Tenet Class. Again, btlbooks.com. We do all this in the interview as well, so just go listen to it, and thanks for joining us. Welcome back to The River and the Land. Travis Laver here with Bilal Rafiq. And we have a really, really special guest today. We've been hyping up having this person on the podcast, it feels like, since day one, and we finally have done it. So this is Dr. Ricardo Tranjan. He's a political economist and senior researcher with the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives. His work can be found all over the internet, including in The Walrus, the CBC, The Toronto Star, and elsewhere. He's the author of two books, Participatory Democracy in Brazil, and for our purposes today, the national bestseller, The Tenet Class. Welcome, Dr. Tranjan, and thank you for joining us.
Hello, and thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great. Like I say, we've been, before we even started this podcast last October, we were talking about having you on, and it took me a while to get around to actually emailing you and figuring that out, so... Thanks so much for joining us. And your book, The Tenet Class, just a brilliant book. As someone who did research for a number of years in homelessness and housing and inequality in Canada, this is to my knowledge at least, is the first and only book that talks about this stuff from a Canadian context. And I think it's just a great book.
Mm-hmm. I think it's the best book on housing since Engels, in my opinion.
Yeah. Thanks. So to start it off, where do you come from? Basically, like, how did you get into writing about this kind of stuff? And what's your sort of background there?
Yes. So I grew up in Brazil in the 1980s, 1990s. So it was a pretty chaotic political, social and economic context. Eventually I came to Canada because of a very generous scholarship from Trent University. Hmm. And I studied international development and then continued on to my graduate studies. And at the end of my doctorate, I got a job with the City of Toronto. And then so I went from political economy and more international and comparative analysis to what felt like a boot camp on social policy in Canada. And then eventually, after a few years with the city, I moved to the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives because I liked very much what they do. It's a think tank that has been around for some 40 years. We have a strong connections with the labor movement and other social movements, providing a lot of research and quantitative analysis support to these movements and to progressive camp more broadly. And then slowly I moved into doing more work on housing, but then I saw that the housing debate in Canada was so dominated by either this classic economic analysis or some public policy analysis. And in both cases, there was no mentions of powers, of social forces, mm-hmm. of conflict, of the fundamental stuff that is driving all of these processes. So I had a chance to bring a little bit back the political economy, critical analysis stuff that I used to do in academia and my knowledge of ongoing housing debates and try to do something that would support, that was my goal, support organizing. So the project really started with a two-pager that I wrote about housing from a class analysis perspective. And I circulated to a number of tenant groups across the country that I had been building relationships with. And my fundamental question was, would this be useful? Mm-hmm. If you had this in front of you, you know, as kind of the more teased out and more in-depth analysis that looks at house from this perspective, which I believe it's the perspective that you already kind of carry on your day-to-day, but it would be sort of articulating words in any paper, would that be useful? And I got a very enthusiastic yes from groups that I was talking to. And so that's how I decided to write the book. It was my way of contributing to the movement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's interesting that it, you know, the book reads very much like a manifesto, which is obviously intentional on your part. And it's interesting to see that it came from a literal pamphlet that you were circulating to tenant groups. That's very old school and very we like that type of organizing. Blah, did you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I just feel like this book is important because in any conversation about housing, the discourse is so saturated with what we know. I think a lot of people know intuitively, but even more so through your book, are just filled with myths. There's a lot of myths about housing and just the way it works in general, and the actual root causes of any issues are completely left out of the discourse. And I think that's what your book provides, is like the... Sorry, I'm just waiting. There's a lot of ambulances going by. The reasons why we're having the so-called housing crisis, which is nothing to do with just like a policy error or the wrong, yeah, just wrong political decisions, but it's a political issue as a whole, and it's a class issue. And that's totally what's missing from all this. But I guess maybe to start, because I feel like I want to use our limited time really wisely with you, is to kind of go through some of these core myths to empower our listeners to be able to take this into their lives and their organizing. But I guess the first one, I guess, is like this idea of a housing crisis at all. Like, you point out that there's no housing crisis, and your book opens with that.
Yeah.
Can you speak a little bit to that? Like, why is there no housing crisis?
Yes, if we had a housing crisis, we would expect something that is surprising. We would expect something that is affecting most of all people. And most importantly, we would be expecting to see something that everyone is genuinely involved and engaged in solving, because no one likes crises and we want to solve them. And that's not really represents well what we have in front of us. Instead, we have a housing system that has been created predominantly to allow for profit generation. We have a really large number of rules and laws that ensure high investments on return in real estate. So this housing system we created, it is not aimed at providing housing security. It is not aimed at housing the largest number of people possible. It is fundamentally about generating profit and returns on investment. So to a certain extent, we have this kind of idiotic conversation on media every day, where I get calls asking, why housing is not affordable? And they're like, well, because that was not the goal, to make housing affordable. And but that's not how we talk about it. We most often than not, we hear the so-called housing crisis framed as a puzzle, as this complex technical problem that we need all the pundits to come and weigh in. And if we just, you know, get the right ideas and just implement them fast enough, the problem will go away. And the last thing I would say is, the part that strikes me as the most naive is that housing is built on land, and land has forever been a fundamental source of conflict in human societies. We have, and we continue to this day, carry out genocides in order to grab land. Presently, we are witnessing one society to try and exterminate another society in order to take over the land and to decimate that population entirely. And this is not, you know, only on the other side of Atlantic. If you look back at the history of so-called Canada, this is how this country started as well. Mm-hmm. You know, by two colonial powers coming over and just essentially wanting to grab the land and carrying out genocide, because that's what it took in order to do so. And so to talk about housing, which is built on land, as if it was not a source of conflict, as if it was not a fundamental political question, is quite naive and historical.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I read one of your, I think it was on CBC, one of the interviews that you did. I just read a transcript of it, and it was very much the interviewer was trying to get you to talk about affordable housing and the housing crisis. And I thought you did a really good job of deflecting the conversation back to, you know, it's not a crisis if it's built into how the housing system actually works, which I thought was really great. But yeah, it's really interesting. Like, you bring in that element of colonialism, you bring in that element, and obviously talking about Palestine and what's going on there, as being sort of a fundamental portion of how classes come together and sort of decide how land is used. And by classes come together, it's usually powerful classes deciding how land is used. And that's just, yeah, you're right, that's just not a part of the conversation at all. But something that I know Bilal wanted to ask at some point as well, you mentioned in your book how a lot of the media narrative, and not just media narrative, but just everyday narrative, whether it's in academia or elsewhere, talks about how the supply side argument is this big part of this. So how do we solve this problem? Well, we just build more housing. We just hand money to developers and we get them to build more housing. And you talk about why the supply side argument is extremely flawed. Would you mind elaborating on that a little bit?
Yes, the real estate industry has been extremely effective at presenting themselves as the solution to the problem. So we have a lot of people experiencing real hardship, paying too much in rent and or paying too much in their mortgage, or not being able to buy a house if that's what they wish to do. And we all trying to figure out how, you know, our way around it, or, you know, why are things the way they are. And there is not very complicated, but more complicated explanation that would talk about the fact that we have a government that de-risks banks, and banks provide ever more mortgages to households who indebt themselves ever more, and that they have this supercharged demand, meaning that people are willing to pay more and more and more and more in housing. And houses. We also have this story about us not investing in social housing and not investing in purpose-built apartments and deregulating the market, the rental market, so that there's fewer and weaker rent controls, and that contributes to price increase. So there is a lot of agency, a lot of decisions that have been taken over the past decades and decades that allowed for houses to become this financial assets that people are essentially gambling on, and for rental units to become a cash cow where landlords can just squeeze tenants of every single penny they have. But we don't talk about this because it would require naming names, would require labeling who is doing what, and mm-hmm. and giving really responsibility over these outcomes that we have right now. Instead, we prefer to talk about the market. Mm-hmm. Supply and demand are these magical forces that should balance itself out and provide optimal results. So the much simpler explanation that we hear is there is not enough housing. That's why it's expensive. If we build more, prices will stabilize. Mm-hmm. And then we say, okay, that sounds reasonable. It sounds reasonable for most people. Yeah, that makes sense. So how do we build more houses? Well, we need to give more incentives to developers because they're really the solution here. And so the governments go and give ever more tax breaks and subsidized loans and other tax and fiscal and financial supports to the industry. And the industry builds more. And guess what? What they build and what they rent is still super expensive, hasn't solved the problem. But there's a circular logic built into the argument, and that's the beauty of it. Because when we come back and say, well, it didn't work, the answer we get is that, wow, we didn't do enough. We didn't build enough. We didn't give incentives enough. Let's give more incentives and build more, and next time around it's going to work. And of course, it never does, because the fundamental financing logic behind it, it doesn't change. So it has been brilliant from the point of the real estate industry to frame themselves as the solution to this problem instead of as the real actual problem, which is what they are. So but it's hard to fight that on the day to day, because the supply and demand thing, it sounds very intuitive.
It does
to a lot of people,
and we're dealing with that right now, because Windsor is in a bit of a thing right now with the federal government, because the federal government has that $4 million housing booster, whatever you want to call it. Windsor applied for its portion and we didn't get it because there's regulations around fourplexes here that our conservative government decided they didn't want to change. And so the more liberal end of the spectrum in council is saying, well, you just cost us however many, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars, that
$70 million
I think it was. And so our argument has just basically been like, well, you were just going to hand that $70 million to developers anyway. Really, we're not losing much over what, like, it's not changing much either way. But the discourse here is that Windsor really screwed up by not getting that $70 million housing accelerator from the federal government. And yeah, it's based all on this. We're just handing it all to developers.
And one way to talk about this with, you know, our friends, our family, our community, and people who are still kind of believing in that narrative. One example that I use is comparing with jobs, right? If a manufacturing company says it's coming to town and it's going to create 5,000 jobs, our immediate reaction is going to say, oh, that's good. But what kinds of jobs? Are they minimum wage, back-breaking jobs? Are you going to throw stuff in the water that's going to make our kids sick? Are you going to build in the only decent park we have in town? We're going to ask all of these questions about what jobs are these and who's benefiting, and are they going to actually be good, and can we, you know, make a living out of these jobs, and so on and so forth. There is a set of critical questions we're going to ask, and you know, don't label us anti-jobs. We're not anti-jobs as most people are not anti-housing. It is just that we have to ask these questions, because we learned that not any job, it's a good job, and jobs by themselves will necessarily help the families and communities. But that, even at that very kind of relatively straightforward level, the critical sense is not there, right? We have been convinced that housing is good. Any housing, anywhere, housing, that's going to solve the problem.
Yeah,
but build it. And if you dare to raise any question about it, it's because you're NIMBY, you're bad, you know? And so that happens at an individual level for community activists and all this. But even more importantly, it happens also at the political level. Right now, for any politician, elected official, to raise questions about development and second guess any development as perhaps not being the best thing for a community, they get immediately labeled NIMBY, anti-development, the real reason for the housing crisis. It's political suicide, which is very dangerous, because we essentially have now the real estate industry dictating what our cities and our city governments do.
Yeah, exactly. So to pivot a little bit, I wanted to ask a question, because you set up the book in a really great way, in that you said the first half of the book is very much, here's the problem, here's what all of these myths are that I'm going to bust. And then the second half is all about the history of tenant uprisings and tenant unionization and you know, what can we actually do to fight this? So I think it's in the second chapter of the book, before you kind of get into that, you talk about tenants as a distinct social class. And I think those two things are related, like viewing tenants as a distinct social class that has the ability to come together and organize. Why do you sort of, or what are the advantages, I guess, to seeing renters in this way as like a distinct social class?
Yes, there's two ways of defending that choice of calling it a social class, or comparing it to the working class. Some of my Marxist colleagues will argue this is not an accurate characterization, right? We can go back to Engels. And we will read that the renter-landlord relationships is at the point of consumption, and it's therefore not as a fundamental as relationships at the point of production. So, you know, the means of that basic distinction between who owns the means of production and who has to sell their labor, it is the fundamental distinction of class. So, that said, I have two ways of arguing for using in the social class. One is that Southern, and I mean the Global South, mm-hmm. scholars have used Marxist terms sometimes quite freely, as long as it supports an emancipatory political project, right? So we feel more comfortable stretching the limits of what the concept is, as long as it helps our movement, and we don't care too much about it. And there's a long tradition of that with Latin Americanists in particular. And I think that's my first and most important defense. I think that in our context right now, we have an exaggerated emphasis on public policy solutions. And that kind of conversation, that kind of apolitical context tends to divide people into many little groups, right? Because mm-hmm. each person is concerned with one particular policy, with one particular group, with one particular perspective on an issue. And I think that is detrimental to mounting a strong political resistance to this. So I mm-hmm. think we fundamentally need more kind of large umbrellas where we have to unite instead of divide. The dividing folks in very small, you know, issues is not helping, I don't think. And so I think using class and the tenant class was my attempt to create this, to propose this broader umbrella where, you know, we know there's a lot of intersectionality and a lot of other things that happen within this class, mm-hmm. but we also know that there's a fundamental distinction between those who own property and those who don't, and that distinction should be enough to unite us in a common front. There is a second, more theoretical-ish defense of the use of class. I think that since Engels wrote that those essays on the housing question, mm-hmm. I think a lot has changed, and some of that has to be taken into account when we're talking about class. And the ones that I would emphasize is for the fact that we pay a lot more attention to social reproduction instead of production. So a distinction that it's fully focused on production, it's a bit gendered. And mm-hmm. so when we think about the social reproduction and the role of house vis-a-vis social reproduction, and the fact that those who are carrying out their work have no control over their house, I think mm-hmm. we start, you know, draw some parallels more with the working class. Also, the financialization of housing and of our capitalist system more broadly, I think it's also important. And once upon a time, you needed to have, you know, a factory and a very concrete collateral in order to be able to borrow more money and then to start another site of production where you would then hire and exploit their surplus labor or appropriate the surplus labor of the surplus labor. But right now, it's a lot simpler to do that, you know? A lot mm-hmm. Right now, anyone with like a half-paid mortgage can go to the bank, get a huge loan, buy another house, and put a tenant there and start, you know, appropriating their income. Mm-hmm. So I think there's even on the theoretical front we could talk about that too. But this was a very 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 long answer. So
no, it's great.
This is what free. We wanted.
We're theory nerds. Yeah. So this is what we like. But
yeah. I like that answer because like when I was reading this book, and I guess like for me, like I'm come from a more orthodox Marxist kind of analysis. So seeing something that's not strictly tied to, you know, the means of production relating to like how we define class was a little bit shocking for me at first. But I think it only makes sense to see that as like a logic, to see the tenant-landlord relationship as a logical extension of what we largely see in the workplace. So I'd say I'm actually very convinced by that argument, because I think the way you put it is like it's almost a form of like double dipping, and they're hyper exploiting, because your wages are being appropriated through wage labor and through surplus value. But then you go home and your wages are even farther degraded. Yeah. And those people who own the means of production are largely the people that also own most of the housing. So it's like it's the same. I don't know. Correct me if I'm wrong or if I'm missing some of the nuance. But it seems like it's largely the same groups of people who are exploiting in the workplace and at home. And I think for the Marxist tradition, we have focused for so long strictly on the workplace, and we've missed a lot of the other aspects of life where this sort of class exploitation occurs.
I think you put it better than I did.
Well, I learned it from you.
And also, I think in the classic definition of class, one important aspect of it is the notion of choice, right? And the fact that laborers have no choice but to sell the labor as a way of survival. And I think it's also something that it's very similar and with housing, right? In especially in a cold country like Canada, but elsewhere as well. We have no choice but to try and be housed somewhere, right? Mm-hmm. And people are at the same vulnerable position in the sense that they have very little negotiating power because they need a house and they need to keep that house, and especially if you know directly engaged not only in your survival but in some sort of reproductive labor where you know your either children or the elderly people who you care for, you know, could be at serious danger should that housing be taken away from you. So you're in a very similar position, I believe, of survival and of reliance on this one thing that only that one person can provide or take away from you at any given moment at their discretion, right? So I think that relation, that sets the stage for a type of relation and an asymmetry of power that is akin to I think what those old guys had in mind back then when we were talking about the working class and the bosses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, connecting it to social reproduction is actually quite brilliant, because it is, like you say, that is the workplace for social reproduction, right? That and you know, housing is not a toaster. You know, it's not a traditional commodity. You can't really talk about housing as being at the point of consumer, because we're not making a free will and choice to consume housing. Like, we have to live somewhere under capitalism. We can't just go in the park and set up a tent, because when they do that, the police come and clear us out. So
exactly,
you know, we have to have somewhere to live. And so it is just like Bilal said, a way of double dipping. So,
And even that, the fact that the state will deploy its enforcement arm in order to ensure that people cannot find alternative ways of living, it's quite telling for me too.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. So, like I say, the second half of the book where you talk a lot about the sort of history of tenant organizing is really powerful, because a lot of the time, even when these books do exist in a non-Canadian context, I can think of, there's a book called Capital City by Samuel Stein that I'm a big fan of, but it's an American context. He's from New York, and you know, he doesn't really necessarily talk too much about the history of political organizing among tenants. And that's something that I think is just such an important aspect, because like I say, we're probably not going to get our solutions from our politicians, because they're more in service of developers than they are in service of communities. And like everything, it's going to come down to working class people organizing. So I guess, I don't know if I have a question related to this or not, but there's still so much of this going on across Canada that we don't even really realize. Like, we talk a lot in this podcast about Parkdale Organize in Toronto, but there's like these sort of tenant movements are actually occurring everywhere. Do you see that as being like the only way that we can fight this? Or I don't know, I have a question there, but I'll just let you kind of elaborate on that.
Just how do we fight this?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
I think we need a social movement response and not a professional civil society response. And I say that as someone who, you know, make a living working within the limits and the boundaries of a professional civil society. But in this world of mine, we are too concerned again in engaging in this already framed debate, and there's this huge pressure for sounding very professional and sounding very pragmatic and providing evidence and so on and so forth. And so an alternative almost by definition cannot come out of this world, right? Because this profession of civil society, it's so fundamentally shaped by where the political consensus currently is. It is something that people openly say in this, all of these NGOs and different groups that engage in advocacy, that we have to adapt to the political times, right? So it is only the freedom that social movements have to propose an alternative vision and literally do not give a shit of how we're gonna get there, or providing the evidence, or providing the policy mechanisms, or all of that. It's just saying that's not our problem. We don't care about that. This is what we want. This is the vision. This is what we're uniting for. How it's gonna be delivered, we don't care. So that it can only come from social movements, I think. And yeah. So we have more of a history of having strong movements and social movements in Canada than I think we acknowledge, because they don't make to the history books that our kids get in school. But it's hard work. It's hard work. It takes, you know, a lot of work to organize anything, and it takes a lot of resources too. And in my perspective, we waste a lot of time and energy and resources with the professional civil society. And I'm talking myself out of a job here, but I
but I've already talked myself out of that job, so and, I hear you.
But we need to channel more, and one of my more concrete pitches on that front is my very polite question for labor, organized labor, and which is, what the fuck are you doing about housing?
Yeah. Well, you mentioned, I think it's in, I used to live in Halifax for about a year and a half, and I think it's in the discussion about the Hydrostone neighborhood in Halifax, where there was that connection to organized labor. It was actually the labor leaders that were pushing for public housing to be built and union-owned housing to be built for workers in Halifax. So that's something that has been tried and successfully done in Canada on several occasions.
Yes, there are other examples of that. And even recently with the rent strikes in Toronto, some of the labor movement came through for it and supported the strikes in important ways. But it's still pretty ad hoc and very dependent on who is the leader of this of that union and whether or not they will show up for it. And it is not yet a deliberate engagement, you know, of labor in housing debate. And for a number of reasons, but I think we lost a lot of labor involvement in the 60s and 70s and 80s, when we had a lot of the unionized workers becoming homeowners, and it kind of settled the problem, you know, for a lot of the unions, and that is not a bad thing, you know. I'm glad that the Zorkers became homeowners. You know, no one wants to have two bosses. You know,
yeah, exactly.
But it, you know, for everyone else who didn't get to become homeowner and who may not want to or may not be able to, there's still a huge fight out there that labor should be directly engaged and help to fund, because it costs money.
Yeah, for sure.
One of our fans sent in a question for
yeah,
you,
right.
Actually. So
yeah,
I wanted to run this by you.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. Yeah.
Yeah, so this is from a fan where basically he quotes the book where he's saying, you know, removing the capital-owning class and its profit motives from rental housing and renting becomes a much more appealing choice than it is made out to be. Talking about how, basically, it's a very long question, but basically he says, so he goes from what I would think is suggesting a transformative change to the system, i.e. removing the capital-owning class and its profit motives, to suggesting that small wins are the way forward. I'd be interested in knowing what his idea of a constructive politics looks like in the context of housing in Canada. Is he suggesting harm reduction or transformative change, or one leading to the other? So I guess he's asking, like, the classic, like, reform or revolution question. Like, do we need to just, like, abolish capitalism to achieve housing equity? Or is to what extent can we achieve that within the confines of a capitalist system?
I think we can remove profit from housing and from rental housing specifically. And it is a slash reform slash revolution in the sense that today only 4% of all housing in Canada, it's not for profit. So on the one hand, you could argue we have it already. It is not magic thinking.
Yeah.
And other countries that we like to compare ourselves with have a much larger share of the total housing stock.
And we used to as well in Canada.
Like a little bit, yes. Yeah. So we could, you know, significantly expand that share of the total housing stock that is not for profit. But here's the trap, though, because there are some sort of kind of consensus-ish emerging that we need more not-for-profit housing. The problem is, my perspective as someone who's kind of embedded in those debates is that we have a certain segment of the liberal establishment that has come to terms with the fact that a residual welfare state needs more non-market housing than we have right now. So we're going to have to build a little bit more of that.
Yeah.
Hence, yesterday there was an announcement on this front, $1.5 billion for non-market housing providers. I don't think that the people proposing this or the people accepting this as a viable policy thinks that we should take this too far. I think if you say to them, what about 40%? Let's go from 4 to 40%. I think like, whoa, no, we don't need that.
Yeah, 4 to 5 maybe. But
exactly. So yeah. So the debate about the non-market housing right now, it's a tricky one because I think a lot of people just means that we need to have the welfare, the residual welfare state needs to be a little bit better funded because there's the very low income folks who will never be able to pay market rents and they need some sort of support. But everyone else, they can be screwed at the marketplace and we don't care. So I think that's the fundamental distinction. But you know, if you say like 75% of all housing, rental housing to be non-market housing, that I think it's a reasonable number. That's my reasonable number, 75%. Yeah. I don't think that's the number that a lot of people get behind.
Yeah, you can leave the penthouses and the high-end condos in the, exactly. the market. Yeah.
Are there examples of countries that have had like around that, around 75% or more public housing? Like, has this been done before?
There are some countries that will near the 20, 30, and even 40% in Europe. I will get them wrong if I can try to say, you know, who has what percentage. But it has been done. But another thing that is interesting is places where tenant protections are much stronger than in Canada, all to the way to the Swedish model, which is collective bargaining rights for tenants, which, you know, I think it's something the movement in Canada could rally around, because tenant protections are important in forms of rent controls and whatnot, but they're taking away it, you know, every now and then. Even, you know, movements fight forever and we get strengthened rent controls, which is great and has a positive impact for those who are paying too much rent, but they usually don't last that long, you know. Yeah. They last until the night, especially in Ontario. Other provinces have been, regulation has been more stable, but in Ontario, it's just a matter of, you know, the next conservative government coming into power and it just disassemble the rent controls. But collective bargaining rights for tenants would be an interesting idea.
Yeah, and that's something I know that Parkdale organizers talked about, as having collective bargaining rights. The book is The Tenant Class, the author, Dr. Ricardo Tranjan. Am I saying your last name right, by the way?
Yeah,
I feel like I should ask that. Okay, perfect. I should ask that off the beginning. But I usually go
just by Ricardo, but thanks for the, Ricardo. Ricardo is fine.
you earned it, you know? Like, I'll call you Ricardo, but...
Great.
There's certain people that need to call you Dr. Tranjan.
I also go by Hey You.
Yeah, nice. But yeah, BTL book. Bisubooks.com, that's the publisher. Is that the best way to purchase the book? Going directly to the publisher?
Between the Lines, I think there's... I think I saw a lot of the small bookstores in various cities also carry it. Public libraries, there's a bunch of public libraries that has a number of copies. And if there is ever anyone listening to this, who is a tenant, an organizer, who really wants to read the book, but you have to prioritize other expenses, shoot me an email. Right?
Yeah.
I wrote this book for tenants and for organizers. It's not the price that should get in the way of you reading it if you think it can be helpful to you.
Yeah, perfect. And that email, rtrangin@policyalternatives.ca, does that one work okay?
Correct.
If people want to do that? Perfect. All right. Well, thanks, Ricardo. We really, really appreciate this. It feels like a bucket list check mark for this podcast to have you on. And maybe we'll have you on in the future again. And if you ever want to come down to Windsor, you just let us know.
I will. Thanks for having me again. Cheers.
Thank you very much, Ricardo.
Thank you so much.